Today, actually, today, in the last few decades, particularly in the last decade, we can maybe have a little inkling into this reality, because there is a resurrection in the world today, a resurrected search for spirituality and meaning. But that's a separate subject that has to do with the unique era we live in today. Now, what is klipa? What is unholiness? What is the power of klipa? Klipa means a shell. Throughout Tanya, we learned about a klipa. What is the power of klipa? Klipa means Hashem created forces that take the level of holiness that is available and accessible in the world then, and distort it and pervert it. Wherever there's holiness, there is always forces of unholiness that attempt to intrude and to manipulate the human being and to pervert that holiness so it should be used for an opposite element. That's what klipa essentially is. So whatever the level of holiness at the time, the energies of unholiness try to use that level of holiness and allow the impact, influence the human being to distort it and pervert it. Thus, during the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, when faith was so prevalent, when faith was so natural, what was the force that could combat that level of holiness? Avodah Zarah. When you read in the Tanakh, the Tzemach Tzedek brings out, you read in the Tanakh, you see that they mamish believed in their idols. How can anybody believe in an idol? They worshipped their idols. They prostrated themselves to their idols. Whether it was a physical idol, whether it was an image, whether it was a celestial body, whether it was a force of nature. How can they worship it? So Machzadik explains, for them, faith was not a strange thing. For us, we don't relate to it because we define reality based on what we see with our physical eyes. For them, metaphysics and spirituality was such a deep ingrained reality that they actually had faith. And therefore, what did it mean that their faith was distorted, that they had real faith in the wrong thing? And they really had faith in it. Or to put it in other words, they believed that their physical substances have a lot of power, contain deep secrets. And the truth is, that Hashem does run the world through forces of nature. And every physical thing does have a lot of spiritual energy to it. But the true faith of the Torah is a faith in one living God, in Hashem Echad, who runs and controls the entire world. And everything in the world is merely as an axe in the hand of the chopper. That the chopper uses the axe, and the axe doesn't have any power, any authority of its own. What was the competition to this type of spiritual sensitivity? It was a distorted sensitivity, where they substituted the living God with other gods, but the issue was God. They were looking for spirituality. Faith was a reality. The truth is, there's Hashem Echad, one God that controls everything in the world. And they attributed divine significance to different physical substances, to different physical powers, to different celestial bodies. Thus, during the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, Nevi'im, prophecy flourished. The Gemara says that there were times during the first Beis HaMikdash where you had Nevi'im kiflayim kiyotzim Mitzrayim. You had Nevi'im prophets in them, double the amount of the Jews that left Egypt, which means 1,200,000 prophets. It's just Nevu'ah shehutzlach l'doros nichtav, the Gemara says in Megillah, 48 prophets are known to us. And these are the prophecies that were transcribed and became part of the Bible, because these are the prophecies that are relevant to all of the generations. Why was prophecy such a relevant thing? Prophecy was then so common because in Kodesh HaKadoshim V'Bayis Rishon, you had a revelation of the realities that are totally transcend the physical world. And that breached, it pierced the veil of egocentricity. It pierced the veil of physicality. The issue was godliness. The issue was spirituality. The issue was faith. What was the combat of unholiness? To substitute. What is God? This is a God, and this is a God, and this has spiritual power, and this has spiritual power, and so forth. Yeah. Okay, good, yeah, I hear.
So I was responding to that. The way I understood the point you were saying is that you would think that they would be more immune, but it's like, yes, they were wiser, and they knew that the island, what it's not, but it seemed like they wanted to get just the effect of it without the effort. Whereas they were able to perhaps come to a spiritual high as if they were worshipping the real God, but through some kind of
That says also in Svarim. It says, It says in Svarim, this Svart, what you're saying, which is really an elaboration of what the Tzemach Tzedek explains, and that is that since godliness was available then, and there were so many prophets, Jews then and people knew the spiritual extraordinary high that the prophet experiences, which is unparalleled. There's no high in enjoyment and bliss in the world that could come close to that high of that mystical experience of sensing the divine voice in creation. It's like getting in touch with the essence. All the pleasures in the world, food and music and everything else, are ultimately derivatives of the greatest source of the pleasures, which is divinity. So mamash, the relationship with the source of all pleasures, is the deepest bliss and delight in the world. There's one problem, however. To experience godliness through the path of Torah, through Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, requires extremely intense effort. The Rambam describes what it takes to become a prophet in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, but even lower levels, the person has to be morally impeccable. The human being has to discipline himself in every area of life. The effort, the intensity to become a champion of spirituality. If you want to become a champion in swimming, to go to the Olympics, you know what type of effort it takes. I mentioned this because today I was invited to speak in the afternoon about Kabbalah and swimming. And after me spoke a Jew whose name is Leno Kreiselberg, who won 3 gold medals in Sydney in the Olympics of 2000 for swimming. And he's a Jewish guy, a Russian young guy who immigrated to America in Los Angeles. And I spoke about the spiritual dimensions of swimming, and he spoke about the physical dimensions of swimming. So he described his training. He started at the age of 5, he began swimming. At the age of 9, he was training 5 hours a day in swimming. For years and years, he had to train 6 hours a day. Every day, 6 hours devoted exclusively to swimming. And when you swim for 6 hours, you have to sleep the rest of the day. It's not like you can do other things the rest of the day. Until today, 6 hours swimming every single day. That's just to reach that. To reach the divine voice in creation, not just a physical sport, which is also very admirable. The effort that it takes is extraordinary effort. And all of these Jews were familiar with that high. And they were familiar with that reality. And this is true what you're saying. The idolatry provided techniques to reach that spiritual high without going through the discipline and the work and the toil and the sweat and the blood that Yiddishkeit requires to reach the true living God. It was like a drug of spirituality that substituted the real spirituality. Microwave godliness. It's hot, fast. Unlike to reach the real voice of God takes a lot of effort. This was Bayis Rishon. And they can have real abstract faith. That's the point. Real abstract faith. Real spiritual experiences. It was available in the world. But it was available in holiness and was available in unholiness. In holiness, it was available through a lot of work. In unholiness, it was available also, but through less work. Always unholiness is that way. It's available through less work. So you had that spirituality available, and this is what Avodah Zarah represented. They were just worshipping. People think, we read Tanakh, they would bow down to a bookcase or to an animal or to a beam. And you think, what were they doing? It wasn't such a simple thing they were doing. It was quite sophisticated. It was quite deep. They felt to have a relationship with God. They knew how to connect to physical objects and to use it for spiritual experiences, for spiritual highs. That's what you meant, I assume. What happens in Bayis Sheni? The Yitzhar Avodah Zarah is gone. The men of the Great Assembly nullified the Yitzhar Avodah Zarah. How could they do it? They could do it because godliness was not present in the world anymore as it was in Bayis Rishon. What did you have? You had the Shechina, but through Yetzirah and through Katshe Kadashim of Asiyah. So during Bayis Sheni, we have two interesting dynamics. First of all, we see during the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, you had the beginning of the explosion of Torah Shebaal Peh. Not of prophecy, there was no prophecy. Of the intellectual revelation of the oral tradition, the Tanoim, first the Zugais, the Tanoim, the authors of the Mishnah. It wasn't like the real explosion in the time of the Gemara after the Churban. We'll see soon, after Rebbe continues the next generation. And what was the competition? Greek philosophy. Philosophy. Not idolatry, philosophy. Greek philosophy included also pagan idolatry, but it was a symptom of philosophy. It engaged the mind, it didn't engage the spiritual soul. That was the competition. You had Torah, the Chachamim, the sages, revealed the tradition of Moshe Rabbeinu. Masorah of Torah Shebaal Peh developed it. And the competition, and it was an intense competition, was philosophy. Secular philosophy that posed an antithesis to the vision and perspective of Torah. But even before we get there, the dynamic that characterized Bayis Sheni historically, everybody knows, is it's considered one of the worst histories, one of the worst points in Jewish history, because of the hatred and the politics between Jews. The massacres, the plots, the murder schemes. If you're familiar with the history of the second Beis HaMikdash, I mean, it's just mind-staggering. They say if the Jews survived the period of the second Beis HaMikdash, they could survive anything. The family feuds, the deaths in the Beis HaMikdash, outside of the Beis HaMikdash, the Chashmonaim victory, the later years of the Chashmonaim, what was going on there, the mutinies, the rebellions, I mean the poisoning, the fights between the Prushim and the Sadducees, between the Zdukim and the Prushim. I mean, it was just unbelievable stories. The bloodshed in Yerushalayim those years could pashut make your hair stand. I mean, the moment the Gemara describes when Yanai, the Sadducee king, who was a descendant of the Chashmonaim, comes on Sukkot of the Beis HaMikdash, right? And he doesn't believe in Nisach HaMayim. So instead of taking the water and pouring it onto the altar, he pours it onto his feet. And 6,000 Jews stone him with their Esrayim. And they're all killed in the Beis HaMikdash. They're all slaughtered. I mean, such types of events were commonplace during the time of Bayesheni. Sinas chinam. It wasn't just hate. Sinas chinam means baseless hatred. So Machzadik explains, what's baseless hatred? It's hatred based on faith. But here's the difference. In the first Beis HaMikdash, the faith was directed to the wrong God. The faith was a distortion in theology. In the second Beis HaMikdash, there was a horrible distortion in sociology. They say Jews were always fighting. It's just they're sophisticated, they gave it sophisticated names. So they fight with God, they call it theology. They fight with the world, they call it sociology. And they fight with themselves, they call it psychology. So sinas chinam is hatred based on faith. But it's not faith in milah d'shmai, it's faith in milah d'alma. Which means, what's it mean, baseless hatred? What's the hatred based on? You really assume and believe that people are evil, that people are out to get you, that nobody can be trusted. This is also an element of faith. But the faith was not directed towards spirituality anymore. It was directed towards social relationships. It's a faith, a corrupted faith that destroyed all social relationships. Metaphysics was not so appealing during the time of the Beis HaMikdash. What defined Klippa then was the lack of faith in other human beings. You believe that everybody was out to get you and out to kill you, and the hate, the animosity just flourished. It was like a cancer. It just gained its own momentum. What allowed this to happen in the second Beis HaMikdash? Which Shechina was present there? First of all, the Shechina of Yetzirah, which is the world of emotions. So the unholiness, the klipa that combated the holiness that was available, was in deep emotions, emotions of hate. Also you had the Shechina and Kodesh HaKadoshim of Asiya, but not a Malchus of Asiya. Which means, you still had a level of Kodesh HaKadoshim of Asiya, which is a higher level than regular physicality, and therefore during the time of the Beis HaMikdash, faith was still present. But on the other hand, super rationality was still a part of the culture, but not like in the first Beis HaMikdash, where the faith was directed towards substituting the living God with a counterfeit God. Now, the faith was directed towards developing negative and developing feelings of hate and animosity and mistrust towards other human beings. It was a level of super rationality that's still connected to sociology, not to theology anymore. The Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah was killed because the Shechina that was present there was a different type of Shechina. And the unholiness, the klipa of each generation, the struggles of each generation are always commensurate with the level of holiness that is available in that generation. This is Bayis Sheni. Let me just learn another two lines. U'mishicharev Beis HaMikdash. The Alter Rebbe continues. The Beis HaMikdash, you still had a center of holiness. And you had the Shechina there. Not only that, according to one opinion, you had the Aron and the Luchas there that was concealed, but it was there. So you had a Kodesh HaKadoshim present in the world that was the brain for the Shechina, a lower level of Shechina, but it still introduced a higher spirituality in the world. And that's why Yitaka had the great giants, the Tanoim, the authors of the Mishnah, the explosion of Teresh of Alpa. You also had a certain element of faith, as I mentioned, and a certain element of spiritual sensitivity, although it didn't express itself in Avodah Zarah. It expressed itself either positivity in deep love or in deep hate. Then you come to the next generation. U'mishacharev Beis HaMikdash. Once the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the second Beis HaMikdash, which was in the year 420 years later, so in other words, in the year Gimel Tav Chav Ches, 3828. Or according to other opinions, 29, or other opinions, 30. But that time, through the Roman Empire, Mishachar of Beis HaMikdash once, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. The Gemara says, "Ein loy la Hakadosh Baruch Hu ba'ilom ayala dalat amas shel halacha b'lvat." Hakadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem, the Holy One, blessed be He, has nobody, has nothing in His world. Ein loy b'ilom ay. He doesn't have anything in his world but the four cubits of halacha alone. This quotes the famous Gemara in Brachas Daf Ches, where the Gemara says that Rava asked Raphram Bar Papa to tell him something that he heard from Reb Chisda. Mahani Mili Malya said that he heard from Reb Chisda. So he quoted from Reb Chisda that Hashem loves Sha'orim HaMetzuyonim B'Halacha, the gates, the centers of the Halacha study, even more than synagogues, more than shuls. And the Gemara quotes Reb Chiya, the son of Abba, in the name of Ula, that this is also what he said, that from the day that Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, Hashem doesn't have in his world, Hashem has nothing in his world but the four cubits of halacha. In other words, that's where Hashem is in the world. Hashem has invested in this world only dalat amas shel halacha. That's where he can be found. That is what attracts him to this world. That is the magnetic force, the force of gravity that, so to speak, connects HaKadosh Baruch Hu to this world. He's found in the dalat amas shel halacha. And that's why Abaye said, and in the beginning I used to learn in my home and daven in shul. But once I heard this statement, that from the day the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the exclusive domain Hashem has in this world is the four cubits of halacha, I began praying where I learn. And the Gemara says, Rabbami and Rabasi had 13 shuls in Tiberias and Tveria, but they davened only among the pillars where they learned Torah, because it's dalat amas shel halacha where the Shechina is. So Alter Rebbe says, here is a new stage. And he adds, "Vafilu echad sheyeshev esig b'teirat shchini ma'ikdisa b'brachas peirakama." This is not only where there's many people, even one person who sits and learns Torah. The Gemara says the first chapter of Brachas Daf Vav Amud Aleph, the Shechina is with him. The Gemara brings the pasuk, "Bechol makim asher askir eshmi avay elecha v'erachticha," wherever you mention my name, I will bless you. So even one person, the Shechina is there. Pirush, what does it mean, Shechina imai? Is it the Shechina of Bayis Rishon? Is it the Shechina of Bayis Sheni? So he says, it's kederech ishtalshulus v'islapshus. This is the Shechina. The Shechina is present with the Torah, with the four cubits, in the four cubits of halacha, or in the person who is learning Torah, in the way that the Shechina evolves throughout the worlds. As the Alter Rebbe explains, Malchus d'Atzilus, b'Malchus d'Briya. Malchus of Atzilus, Malchus of Briya. V'Yitzir, and then in Malchus of Yitzir. V'Asiya, and then in Malchus of Asiya. Unlike Bayis Shein, Bayis Rishon was absolutely transcendental. Malchus of Briya was in the world. Bayis Sheini, Malchus of Yitzira, in Kodesh Kodashim of Asiya was in the world. After the Churban, we don't anymore have that spiritual island, that spiritual oasis, where the Shechina of a higher level of reality is revealed, and therefore you can't walk in there, and it's dangerous spiritually to walk in there. That doesn't exist anymore. But we have the Torah. And the Torah is now the brain. It's the Kodesh HaKadoshim. The Torah substitutes Kodesh HaKadoshim in our world. Torah is now the meeting place. It's the instrument. It's the home for the Shechina. The Shechina that descends in the evolution of the world. Malchus of Atzilus, Yitzbriya, Yitzira, and in Malchus of Asiya, unlike Bayis Shein, now comes into Torah. Torah are the Dalet Amas, the four cubits that are the home, the cosmic brain that is the home of the divine energy. And it's from there transmitted and allocated to the entire world during the time of Golos, during the time of exile. So the Shechina is here with this person, but you will not have that spiritual sensitivity that comes from a higher revelation of Shechina. That does not exist anymore. And here the Alter Rebbe defines history after the Churban. In many ways, yes, but in many ways, not. In many ways, yes, you're dealing with a nation that has been through thousands of years of history and of self-sacrifice and refinement. You're also dealing with a generation before Mashiach. So in that sense, yes, but on the other hand, there were certain levels of perception then that we don't have today. Those of us who are looking to the Torah as our guide are spiritually stronger. Huh? The Gemara says in Sanhedrin that Menashe, the son of Chizkiah, who was a great worshipper, a great idolater, he was a champion of idolatry. So he came in a dream, I think, to Marbe Rabashi, the son of Rabashi. And he told him, he said, if you would have lived in my day and age, huh? Right. Not only would you engage in idolatry, but you would be lifting your skirt, you would be lifting your robe from the ground, that it shouldn't hinder your running to go worship idols. Maral explains what the Gemara means. Maral over there in Chiddush HaGadol explains the Gemara means as follows. You know, everybody wants to sin once in a while. But if you have an obstacle, you celebrate the fact that you had an obstacle and you didn't sin. He says, you, Marbe Rabashi, you would have been so attached to idolatry if you would have had an obstacle. You would have removed the obstacle and fought the obstacle to go and sin. That's how connected you would have been to it. So it was obviously a very profound inclination. What happens after the Churban of Bayis Sheni? Now there's a whole new thing. Now if you want the Shekhinah, you can't go to the Beis HaMikdash anymore. You have to open up a Torah, you have to open up a book of Torah, and you have to learn Torah. Or you have to go to somebody who teaches Torah. In other words, now the Shekhinah expresses itself and lives in this world through the garb of Torah. And when it's expressed through the garb of Torah, it's expressed in the ordinary process of evolution, which means it goes all the way through Malchus Da'asiya, which is the source of nature as we know it. So thus, from the time of exile, the way the Jew searches and discovers God is in nature. Very, very seldom will the Jew have a revelation that will transcend nature. Our entire service of Hashem must consist of searching and finding the light within our body, the light within our jobs, within our family life, within the physical world. Now the Shekhinah is communicated only through the garb of Malchus Asiyah. But how do you relate to the Shekhinah? Through Torah. Torah, when somebody learns Torah, doesn't turn them into miraculous human beings. What Torah does is, it allows us to find the Shekhinah that's transmitted in Torah, that's invested in Torah through Malchus Asiyah. Torah is the brain that allows us to find meaning within the physical organism. Torah does not take us out from the boundaries of this world. That's not the Avodas Hashem after the Churban. What Torah allows us is to find the extraordinary within the ordinary, to find the miracle within the natural. to find excitement within the monotonous day-to-day schedule. That's how the Shechina is present now. In the Churban, the Shechina comes in, but it's in Torah, and it has to go through the process of Malchus Da'asiyah, and therefore it expresses itself within the daily routines of physical living, and the Torah allows us to experience the Shechina in those daily routines. Yes, but it's not a common property. There are Jews who live in generations and they're a throwback to Bayis Sheni, or a throwback even to Bayis Rishon. The Medrash Rabba says, Bereishis Rabba Parshan and Zayin, Ein Lechadar Shein BeKamoisha, that in every generation you have a Moshe Rabbeinu. But those are unique individuals. Like I told you last week, the story about the Baal Shem Tev as the Luchazan and the Mezhebush. In Mezhebush you had a human being who personified the Luchas Rishonis, who personify the tablets. But Alter Rebbe is now talking to the Jew, to the individual Jew. Dalet Amos Shel Halach, in Torah, in the Gemara, in the Mishnayos, in the Tanya, in the Sefer of Halach, in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Tanakh, whatever it is, that's where you'll find the Shechina. You're not going to have a corner in the world, a Tibetan mountain where you will climb up to and you'll have a revelation of other worlds. It's not going to happen that way. In the Torah, you'll have the Shechina. And which Shechina will you have? You will not have an explosion of the higher worlds. You will have the Shechina as it goes through the entire revolutionary process and is garbed in Malchus Da'asiyah and therefore sustains and relates to nature and vitalizes the physical world. But what's the abode for that Shechina? It's in Torah, and Torah transmits it to the world. And therefore, when you learn Torah, you don't fly beyond Malchus Da'asiyah, but you learn that within your life and within your body and within your struggles and within your challenges, you are a spark of godliness charged with the mission of ultimately creating that integration between heaven and earth, between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the world. It's interesting, the Baal Shem Tov once said, in his original perspective, he explained the Gemara. He says, "Mishacharav beis hamikdash ein leila kadosh baruch hu beilam el dal ramesh lalachav olvad." Literally, it means once the beis hamikdash was destroyed, Hashem used to have a place in the world in Yerushalayim. Now he has only one place, 4 cubits of halacha. You have 4 cubits of halacha, he has a stock in this world. You don't have 4 cubits of halacha, he doesn't have a stock in this world. It's not for him, this world. So Alter Rebbe explains it beautifully. This is the brain. You want the soul, you need a brain. The soul can't come into the stomach. You need a brain. The brain is the home for the soul. Torah is the Kodesh HaKadoshim. That's where the Shechina dwells today. That's the place. In Bayis Sheni, you had a Kodesh HaKadoshim. There you had a concealed Aron. In Bayis Rishon, you had a revealed Aron. Now you have Torah. You have the literature of Torah. The Baal Shem Tov once touched Azai. Mishacharav beis hamikdash, ein leil HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'aylam el adal ha'am shal halach b'lvat. Mishacharav beis hamikdash. What is the symptom of the Churban? What is the symptom of the destruction of Beis HaMikdash? That people think that Ein Lo Ela Kodesh Baruch Hu Be'Elam El Adal Ramah Shel Halacha B'Levad. That Hashem could only be found in Halacha. That's a symptom of the Churban. He said, Mishacharav Beis HaMikdash. Before the Churban Beis HaMikdash, everybody knew the world is a godly place. Mishacharav Beis HaMikdash. God was relegated to the Dal Ramah of Halacha. He can't be found in the world anymore. In your eating, in your sleeping, in your businesses, in your relationships, in your interactions, you can't find Hashem anymore. That's a symptom of Mishacharav Beis HaMikdash, that you think that He's only in Dalet Amos. Now obviously, the Alter Rebbe is not following here this interpretation. But like everything of the Baal Shem Tov's interpretation, it's never a contradiction to the literal interpretation. Because what is the function of a brain? The function of a brain is to take the soul and contain it, and not allow anybody else to enjoy it. On the contrary, such a brain is not a brain. The function of a brain is that it's the central nervous system that then allocates the energy to the entire body. So therefore, the literal interpretation and the Baal Shem Tov's kvetch are really one. Because when you have the Dalet Amos Shel Halacha and you have the Shechina there, then the Dalet Amos Shel Halacha, like a brain, transmitted to the entire world. And therefore, wherever, whatever part you look at the world, Like a body, when you look at a hand, if the brain is functioning, you see the hand from another perspective, like we discussed a few weeks ago. A brain without a hand is a brain that's not alive. Or even imagine if a brain, theoretically, if a hand can be alive without a brain, it has no meaning, it has no destiny, it has no purpose, it has no symmetry, it has no coherence, it's not part of the other elements of the body. The same is true with the world. The world without Torah is basically a jungle that just goes and goes. It has no destiny, no coherence. It doesn't have the dignity of purpose. It doesn't have the symmetry. It doesn't have the depth. You don't see where it's leading. You don't see how everything is part of a jigsaw puzzle. But once you have the Torah, the Shekhinah is allocated to every part of the world. Now, a good example for this, and this is what I want to finish with, is Purim. Because Purim didn't happen during the time of the Beis HaMikdash. Purim occurred actually in the transmission, in the transition era between the first and the second Beis HaMikdash. And Purim is a classical example of what the Alter Rebbe is saying here. I'll illustrate it with this story. It's a very interesting story. The Baal Shem Tov had a son, his name was Reb Tzvi. When the Baal Shem Tov passed away, Shavuos Tav Kuf Chav, Shavuos 1760, Reb Tzvi succeeded him in the leadership of Chassidus. But Reb Tzvi was a great man, but he was not his father. 1 year later, Shavuos 1761, the entire Chevraya Kadisha, the holy students of the Baal Shem Tov, were sitting at the table. Reb Tzvi was sitting at the head table, and he was wearing the garments of his father, the white garments that his father would wear on Yom Tov. And in the middle of the meal, Reb Tzvi turned pale, and he looked at all of the students, and he said, "The Tata is by Mir Yerush Geven. My father just came to me, the Baal Shem Tov, and he told me, as the ganze pamal yishal maila is a ribur to the ber, that the heavenly assembly was transmitted to the ber, the Mizrach Magid." And he took off the clothes and he put it on the Mizrach Magid and he says, "You're the Rebbe." And the Mizrach Magid was unanimously appointed as the successor of the Baal Shem Tov in the second generation of Chassidus, and served as the mentor of the Alter Rebbe and all of the colleagues of the Alter Rebbe, the great luminaries of that generation. This story itself tells you something about the character of Reb Tzvi to do such a thing. And the Gemara describes, right, in Hiriyas, that even people who'd never wanted to accept leadership, but once they accepted it, they never gave it up. Because there's a level of consciousness you become sensitive to. You know, in a way, you become the brain of the generation. So you become a shtikl kodesh hakadoshim. If you're in the Holy of Holies, you don't leave. You just don't leave. On the contrary, even if you're corrupt, you'll bribe your way in there, but you don't leave voluntarily. But Reb Tzvi left, and he gave it to the Magid, and you never hear from him again. 1 year, Reb Tzvi came to visit the Magid on Purim. He made his own meal. So the Magid called in the Alter Rebbe, Purim by day, and he said, "You go do the meal of Purim with Reb Tzvi." The Alter Rebbe was very unhappy, because that meant missing Purim with the Magid. And the Alter Rebbe, to miss a feast of Purim with the Magid, was a great loss, an indescribable loss, and he was very upset. But he didn't ask questions. To honor his Rebbe's wishes, and in honor of the Baal Shem Tov's son, he listened. Begrudgingly, he went to Reb Tzvi and he had the Suda there. As you can imagine from the character of Reb Tzvi, he ate and he didn't say a word. So the Alter Rebbe really felt bad. Not only is he losing the Magid's feast, he's not even getting anything. So the Alter Rebbe turns to him, he says, "Reb Tzvi, zachta pesavart, you know, say something." He doesn't say anything. The Alter Rebbe had a son also, his name was Reb Chaim Avram. And when his brother passed away, the Mittler Rebbe, people were nudging him to take over the leadership, but he refused. And he wanted his nephew, the Tzemach Tzedek, his sister's son, to take over the leadership. And that's what happened. Tzemach Tzedek took over, and Reb Chaim Avraham never became Rebbe. But Reb Chaim Avraham was an extraordinary scholar and a great spiritual giant. They would nudge him to say something from his father. They would beg him and beg him and beg him. He would never say anything. Once, by a Shabbos table, the Walanach Siddin, they said, Zagat Pesam Maimer, say something over from the Alter Rebbe. So he made with his, he consented, he made with his, okay, I'll say something. And he says, he quotes the pasuk, he says, "Belibi tzafanti imrasecha l'man layechtalach." In my heart have I concealed my sayings so that I should not sin to you. And that was it. "Belibi tzafanti imrasecha." So Reb Tzvi was the same character, same type of person. He's not saying a word. So Alter Rebbe is nudging and nudging. Finally, Alter Rebbe says, "Zaktepes von Taten." Say something from the Baal Shem Tov. No, he couldn't. He said something he heard from the Baal Shem Tov that he once heard from his father at the Purim meal. He told Alter Rebbe that what is the miracle of Purim? The miracle of Purim is the story in Zohar Parshas Mishpatim. In Zohar Parshas Mishpatim, there's a story which is obviously a mystical story that has to be understood as a metaphor. That tells the Zohar every morning. King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, whom you mentioned before, would climb to the roof of his palace. On the roof of his palace, each morning, there awaited him an eagle. Shlomo HaMelech would climb onto the wings of the eagle, and the eagle would soar with him, and they would fly to the heavens. When the eagle, with Shlomo HaMelech on top of it, would make its voyage under the sun, it would obviously eclipse the light of the sun. So the Zohar says, suddenly everybody on the earth experienced darkness. Eclipse of the sun. A sun eclipse. So the Zohar says there were two types of people. The chahai chachimoi, the wise, intelligent people, would see darkness. They would say, ah, Shlomo HaMelech is flying. The foolish people, Hanitipshoi, the Zohar says, the foolish people would say, ah, those clouds have just overtaken the heavens, have spread themselves all over the place, and are eclipsing the light of the sun. This, the Baal Shem Tov said, is the essence of the Purim miracle. When the Baal Terebbe heard this, he was so excited. He loved it so much. He couldn't thank the Maggid enough for sending him to Reb Tzvi, that he heard this vart of the Baal Shem Tov. That's the story that was given over. Now the question is, what is the meaning of the story? For the Alter Rebbe, it was very nice. What's the meaning of the story? So the truth is, if you read the Alter Rebbe's discourses on Purim, one of the most central, one of the themes that he discusses in Torah Eir Megillas Esther, is perhaps his understanding of this particular story. And this is how Chassidim used to explain it. Apparently, when you read the Zohar, something is difficult to understand. You don't see light, so you look up. You see what's going on. How is it that one set of people said, oh, it's Shlomo HaMelech, and other people said it's clouds? You could look up. Everybody knows what clouds look like, and you could see when the clouds are spread out, people could notice it. They could see if there are clouds or there are no clouds. If there are clouds or it's a bird. So you must conclude that obviously there were clouds. Obviously there were some clouds. And Shlomo HaMelech was also flying with an eagle. And you can interpret it in two ways. You can attribute the event, the darkness, to the clouds. Or you can attribute the darkness, hey, it doesn't have to do with the clouds. The clouds wouldn't have created this darkness. It has to do with Shlomo HaMelech is flying over. Now, how is this the miracle of Purim? This is essentially the story of Purim. Whenever there is a darkness that befalls the universe, befalls the Jewish people, befalls the Holy Land, befalls a generation, it's dark. Darkness descends on a world. The light of the sun is not present. So the foolish people say, of course, the clouds are here. There are natural clouds that once in a while wake up, they take over, they become the kings in heaven, and they eclipse the sun, and this is what caused the darkness. Says the Zohar, the wise ones say, no, 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 it has nothing to do with the clouds. I know there are clouds, and you can attribute it to the clouds. Shlomo HaMelech himself, Shlomo HaMelech is known, his name Shlomo is a metaphor always in Kabbalah and Chassidus to Hashem, Melech Shahashalom Shaloi, the king to whom peace belongs. Shlomo comes from the word Shalom, peace, Shlomo's perfection. Shlomo HaMelech, which means the same God that usually projects the light, that same God is flying, so to speak, across the sun or in front of the sun and eclipsing it. It's not the clouds that are eclipsing the light. It's that same God that extends the light, projects the light. He is concealing that light. The same one who forms light is the same one who creates darkness. What is the story of Purim? I told somebody on Shabbos, I said, imagine the New York Times would report the Purim event. Imagine. What would be the nature of the headline? It would obviously be an 8-column headline. The font would be 70. Be a big, nice, big font. What would be the headline? They would tell the story. The story would be one headline, and that is as follows. First Lady, Mrs. Achashverosh, Mrs. Bush, it would be Mrs. Achashverosh. First Lady, Mrs. Achashverosh, influences her husband, the president, the king, to nullify the decree from the Jewish people. And you would read a story that would tell you a story of clear-cut politics, diplomacy, savviness, a smart first lady, a smart Yiddish cop, a Jewish woman. The first thing is she threw one party, got her husband drunk and got the minister drunk, threw a second party, got her husband drunk, got the minister drunk, and in a moment of sweetness, she charmed her husband. She impacted him. She seduced him, whatever she did. And in a moment of vulnerability, she said, listen, I need you to remove the decree. And then at the end, they would add, some fundamentalist, ultra-Orthodox, Hasidic Jews from Brooklyn call it a miracle. That would be a paragraph at the end. When they would describe the decree itself, what would be the description? Description would be this, a similar thing. A chancellor rises to power, Haman, a member from the State Department, right? Or from the UN is also not bad. And gives out a decree, right? Against Israel, against these headlines, and gives out a decree against the Jewish people. And you would read and you would say, these are the clouds. These are the clouds. That's it, it is. So thank God, Mordechai, the Jews from that generation weren't reading the New York Times because we wouldn't celebrate Purim. We would celebrate a good first Jewish woman who did the right thing in the right time and used her diplomatic skills and her political power to get things done. Suddenly you take it from a Jewish Torah perspective, it's another Maisa. It didn't become dark because of the clouds and didn't become light because the clouds went away. It was Shlomo HaMelech who eclipsed the sun, and it was Shlomo HaMelech who allowed the sun to get revealed. From a political external point of view, it wouldn't be that way. Achashverosh comes to power. He makes a party. He wants his wife Vashti to expose herself. She doesn't want to. She gets executed. Fine. One mice. Nice story. It would also make front page in the newspaper. Queen gets executed. Then years later, two people want to assassinate a king. Also a nice story. Bixen Vasarish. Mordechai happens to want to be to give the message. Between the two stories, it happens to be that Esther is appointed queen. That in the middle of the story, Haman decides to annihilate the Jewish people. Each story independently, it's basically clouds. Either the clouds are there, the clouds are removed. But the Torah perspective is, you see, Yad Hashem Asas Azois. That throughout every moment of history, every political event, every natural event, every news event, ultimately Shloima HaMelech flying on his eagle. Both the darkness and the light. It comes through Malchus of Asiya, that's true. But it's the Shechina that runs the events. And who reveals it? The Torah. The Torah is the glasses that allow you to view life. Torah tells you how to read a newspaper, how to read the news, how to see the news. And that's why it's interesting. The Bnei Yisachar brings from Megala Amukus. The Megala Amukus writes, Eifin Memdalet, every month has its angel. The angel of Adar is a malach called Avrachiel. Avrachiel, Aleph Veiz, Reish Chaf, Yud Aleph Lamed, is the same gematria as the word Seder, order. Because the angels represent divine emotions, divine expressions of energy. What characterizes the miracle of Purim, unlike other miracles, unlike Yitzias Mitzrayim, there, with all of the explanations, the headline would have to be water turned into blood. I mean, fine, you would have scientific explanations. Or a sea suddenly split and the entire nation was saved and the entire Egyptian nation drowned. You can have scientific explanations. Rabbi once told the secretary, Rabbi Label Groner, I heard from him, he said, the Rabbi told him that, what's means is given by Kriyas Yamsov? Ich sage, this is given Yidden, was ham gesehen Kriyas Yamsov, was ihm gesagt, so hat geblossen auf Wintel. There were Jews standing, and they said, our mazel, a wind came, and it split the water, and we went in, and punkda afterwards, and it says in the Pasuk, there was a ruach kadim, there was a wind. Why there had to be a wind? Because ultimately, there is always, in this world, there's always the choice, but you still can't compare. That's not Malchus Darsiyah. That Shechina of the higher worlds was revealed. But Purim was Malchus of Asiyah. You're dealing with pure politics. Comes Torah and says, it's politics, but it's a miracle happening through politics. And every event was orchestrated meticulously so that at the right point, the Jewish people should be able to be saved through Esther's diplomacy. So Avrachiel is the numerology of Seder because it's divinity as it's expressed through order, through structure, through ordinary, boring, monotonous forces of economy, of politics, of history, of diplomacy, and so forth. I once heard an anecdote. I'll finish with it. I once heard an anecdote of a child who wanted $100. He came to his mother. He says, "Go to Tati." He goes to his father. "I want $100." His father gives him a quarter. "What do you need $100 for?" It's a typical. So who does he turn to? He turns to his God. He writes a letter. He says, "Dear God, this is your child speaking to you, writing to you. Please, I need $100. My mother wouldn't give it to me. My father wouldn't give it to me. Please give me $100. Puts it in an envelope. He stamps the envelope and he addresses the envelope to the Lord in the USA. He thinks if Hashem is everywhere, he must be in America too. So he writes to the Lord over the U.S. The Lord in the USA. Right? The Lord must be somewhere in the USA. Post office gets it. So a few years ago, the Lord of the USA, who do they send it to? They send it to Bill Clinton. The Lord of the USA gets the envelope, he opens it up, he sees a letter, and he's moved, it touches it. It's a very innocent, moving letter. So he tells his secretary, he says, send the boy back $5 in the mail. You know, he thinks a child will get $5 in the mail, he'll be overjoyed, he'll be ecstatic. The boy gets the letter, he opens it up, he sees $5, he writes a thank you letter to God. And this is how it reads. Dear God, thank you so, so much for sending me $100. It's just a pity you had to send it through Washington because those crooks, as usual, deducted 95%. that's the perspective of a child. Yeah. So this is most probably what the Baal Shem Tov meant. This is the essence of Purim. What's Purim? Purim is the recognition that the money comes from Hashem. It's just sent through Washington. It's sent through Washington, but it comes from Hashem. Have a wonderful week on Afreilich in Purim. We'll continue, God willing, next week.
To order additional MP3 CDs, call Heichal Menachem at 718-633-1076 or visit us at www.chassidus.com. That is chassidus.com.